think it's very difficult when you leave drama school, and particularly if it's been 3 years and you've made that very close-knit group, and then you just go out into the world. And as you said, you know, at drama school, you know, I was playing, you know, 65-year-old women aged 20 and all that sort of stuff. And then you go out and you meet a 65-year-old and you think, oh, you're living and breathing and you're actually playing that part. Where does that leave me exactly?
Hello and welcome to episode 25 of Don't Be So Dramatic. I'm Steve Bradley. This week we bring you another off-the-record talk with Chairman of the Actors' Centre, Paul Clayton, and the incredible Imelda Staunton. Wow, are you going to enjoy this? You get to hear how her career started, what inspired her to become an actress, Harry Potter, going to the Oscars. I'm not going to spoil anymore, but it's great. You're going to love it. So here we go. Recorded live at the Actors Centre. Here it is, Imelda Staunton, Paul Clayton, off the record. Let's go.
Welcome to my bedroom.
I know, I was going to say. We should have actually turned that round, shouldn't we, and done one of those nice, you know, morning TV.
I'm going to sit on that cushion, that's better.
Brilliant. They're quite friendly. Hello. Thank you very much for giving up your lunchtime and coming along. I'm Paul Clayton, and I'm the chairman of the board of the Actors' Centre, and welcome to Off the Record. And this is a series of chats where I have the absolute luxury of talking to people whose work I like and respect, and you're going to get the chance to ask some questions as well, too. Today I'm thrilled to welcome... I shouldn't use the pun, should I? But I should say a giant of the London theatre and stage scene, and possibly one of the most watchable actresses I think we have around in Britain today. It's the delightful and twinkly Imelda Staunton. I'm really boring. I start most of these chats the same way, and I go right back to the beginning. Can you identify the moment when what happened today started?
Well, I'd always done school plays.
Okay.
Like I'm sure a lot of people here. But then I had... we did the Beggar's Opera, I remember, with the boys' school across the road. Yes, got my hands on some of them. But I went to a convent, and at the convent we had an elocution teacher... And I didn't know this, but she also taught drama after school and did the Lambda exams and things like that. And she saw me do one of the plays, and I still know her, Jackie Stoker, today. And she said, I do think you ought to come along and do some drama. So I did, and I started doing, you know, the drama festivals in London. And she was a tremendous force for me, mm-hmm. And absolutely, there was no doubt in her mind, you must go to drama school. Oh, right. And although I remember I had written in my diary, you know, I would like to be an actress, but only if, you know, my mum and dad say it's okay. Because we weren't a theatrical family at all. My mum was a hairdresser, my dad worked on the roads, Irish family in Archway. But they were very supportive, and because she was so clear about what I should be doing... I sort of followed her lead, really.
And you went to the best drama school, as they say.
I only got in there.
Okay.
I didn't get in. I auditioned for Guildhall, for Central, and for RADA.
Okay.
And I heard in reverse order, you didn't get into Guildhall, didn't get into Central. Well, that's that then. But then I did get into RADA, so.
Okay. And some illustrious peers when you were at RADA.
Well, yeah, so I was there 74, 76. I auditioned at 17, I went at 18. And I loved it. And in those days, we had terms. We didn't do years. But in my time there, sort of 74, 76, you know, Tim Spall and Juliet was younger, Stevenson and Alan Rickman, you know, they were there at the same time. So I had a lot of people to look up to, I have to say, when I was there.
What was the thing that you think you got out of that training?
Well, I mean, I went in there like a sponge, I have to say, and I just soaked up everything from your rubbish... to that's better. And that was fine by me. And I think that's all. It's always fine by me, because I think otherwise you don't change or you don't develop unless you're prepared to listen to the bad stuff, which is positive in its way, because mm-hmm. you know, we all learn, as we all know, from our failures and all that. So I really soaked. I loved every second of it, and I have to say there was a point where. You know, the principal at the time, Hugh Crutwell, who was married to Geraldine McEwan, and he was absolutely tremendous. And I remember we did in our final term, we did a night called Stand Up and Entertain, which was just a mad, silly night, and I can't even remember what I did now, but I did something. He called me into the office and he said, you know, you were absolutely tremendous last night. And I was just doing a fast. I said, oh, great, thanks, yeah. He said, because you've been so boring since you... And I, you know, I didn't do that reaction. I can tell you that. I'm sorry. Yes. Oh my God, you've been, because you were such a spark at the audition, and you've just been. And he kept saying boring, and you know, what did you do? You did Varia and Cherry Should. God, you were boring in that, and blah blah. So I got really angry. Just in that, you know, when you feel you're wrong, you just go. Fucking shut up. Anyway, I left that room and I was rehearsing with Richard Digby Day at the time, okay. The Ghost Train. And that was a Friday morning at about 9:30. So I went into rehearsal and I said to the director, I'm going now and I'll be back Monday. What do you mean? That's it. So I went home and I really thought about what he said. And I thought, well, he's not... You know, I was so upset... Because I didn't think I was great, but I thought I'm at Rada, I must be marvellous. But I didn't. But I thought I must be okay because I'm here. Well, that's not good enough. It obviously wasn't good enough, and he was right. So I went and I had a long, long think over the weekend and thought, well, you either get back on the horse and get in there and take that advice and use it, and don't just keep thinking about what about me and I'm so upset. No, come on. So that was a very good lesson for me, and it worked, and. So that was very good for me.
So, in a way, I suppose you've answered my next question, because there's a big debate now about training, and Rada was 8 terms or 12
yeah,
terms?
Nine, yeah, 9, actually.
Yeah. And now the classic drama training of 3 years is an expensive undertaking for people. People are saying that it eradicates some people who come from certain levels of society,
yeah.
that they can't afford to do that. Mm. Is it worth it? Is training worth it? Do you think we have to rethink how we train actors?
Yes, it's funny, because actually, art, we were just over 2 and a bit years.
Yeah.
And it didn't seem too long or too short, it sort of seemed okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to say, sort of 3 years, I think 3 years, blimey. That seems a little bit long, I don't know why. And luckily, my daughter is at Guildhall.
Okay.
Doing her first year. And there's the sort of scraping the surface. You know, I'm going, 3 years? You don't bloody well need 3 years. And actually, the work they've done now, I think, well, that's rather good. I'm quite impressed about how they're doing those 3 years. Listen, if you're a great actor, you're going to be a great actor, you know, whether you're at drama school or not. Mm-hmm. But what drama school does give you, I think, is tools. It's like getting the alphabet in order to spell properly. That's what I feel, and I really needed it,
yeah.
And I think a lot of people do need it, because the scattergun thing of, you know, oh yeah, I'm doing a big telly, and I'm blah, 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 blah. Yeah, but it's just honing down your craft, and remember, this is a craft, and I think that craft needs constant attention, and I think to get training at the beginning puts you in very good stead. Now, that training can be a year, 2 years, 3 years. But I also agree about the financial, you know, situation. I got a grant.
Yeah.
And when we were there, you know, people had been to university and then went to drama school and they got a grant. So I don't know how people afford... I mean, but it's the same with university. I don't think actors are any different.
No.
It's just a student life. I mean, it's just terrible that we cannot provide for our young people to be trained.
No. And I suppose when you came out, and I know, I think it was probably around about the same time as I was leaving drama school, there was a more sort of accessible plan. I mean, you just mentioned about this scattergun approach of, you know, young actors now can come out and do a day on the telly and this. There's no... Mm. There was a sort of plan...
Apprenticeship,
there about,
then.
There was the repertory system.
Mm.
And you went out to several reps, didn't you, and did quite a lot. And you did some fantastic stuff in rep.
Yes, I mean, I did 6 years in rep. But I have to say, I'm not one of those people who thinks, well, you see, those were the days. Because I think these are the days, too. Yeah. And it's just different. That's all. It's just different. And it's trying to retain your integrity and your hopefully the way that you continue to learn and get better and better all the time rather than just go job. And I think probably there's no doubt that, I mean, I did a lot of big parts in rep, not very well, but I was given the opportunity to take on a hell of a lot of responsibility very early on. And I don't know if I would have got that sort of sense of responsibility and sense of what am I doing, I don't quite know how to do this, but I'm giving it a go, if I'd just done a day here and a day there. I also didn't want to go and stand at the back at the RSC. Mm. I'd rather be at the front making mistakes and take responsibility for that also. And I don't, you know, but at the same time, I know Juliet Stevenson, you know, she did a long stint at the RSC before she then got, you know, it's just different paths you take. But that was a choice I made because, you know, I did go up for this thing, but I thought, no, I don't want to do that. I want to try and, you know, be at the front and make mistakes.
But it did give, what rep did give you, and I think what gave people, and it's still around today in various other forms, is that sense of suddenly being in a company of people you felt reasonably safe with because we'd do several plays together.
Mm.
And we were talking that season at Nottingham, we were all the same people doing five or six plays for 4 months.
Mm.
So when you walked into the rehearsal room in the morning, you were walking in to friends, really.
Mm. I think it's very difficult when you leave drama school, and particularly if it's been 3 years, you've made that very close-knit group, and then you just go out into the world. And as you said, you know, at drama school, you know, I was playing, you know, 65-year-old women aged 20 and all that sort of stuff, and then you go out and you meet a 65-year-old and you think, oh, you're living and breathing and you're actually playing that part. Where does that leave me exactly? So, but to go out and not have that group that you're with anymore. So rep did continue that for all of us to go into another group of actors who were, you know, trying to start out and to continue the work that they'd been doing, but slightly differently because, as you said, then you were playing your own age, which was that sort of odd. But I think they do. I think maybe at drama school now you're not playing 90-year-olds. Maybe you are. Of course you are, because those parts are worth playing because they're characters. And I have to say, I think English actors are built on character work. You know, our history is theatre. America's history is film. And the difference is, you know, Judy Dench and Maggie Smith, and yes, they're leading players, but they're all character actresses too.
Yeah.
You know, we don't mind not wearing makeup. Or, you know, having our own faces.
Right, I'll just cross the plastic surgeon. Did you get spotted in rep then? Because you then came into the National, didn't you? Mm. Eventually, after that time.
Yeah, so I did 6 years, and then I had so my final two roles in rep were one after the other was Piaf and Mac and Mabel. And I then got an audition for Richard Eyre's company at the National. That was in 1981. I got two auditions in 1 week. I got that to join his company, and the other audition was to take over from Elaine Page in Cats. And I didn't get Cats, and I did get Richard's company. And but even at the time, it was a joy to be in the chorus of Guys and Dolls and just to join his company. And you know, I'd played Electra and St. Joan and all these parts. What the bloody hell am I doing? Going in the bloody chorus of a musical. Ah, blah, 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 blah. And then I thought, well, what? Hello. And you're working in London at the National Theatre. That's what you're doing here. And I remember in rehearsals watching Bob Hoskins, Julia McKenzie, Julie Covington and Ian Charlson. And I thought, that's why I'm here, because I have to up my game by about 2,000%. So that's what you want to be. It's like tennis players. You've got to play with better players in order to So that was it was wonderful for me.
And then you took over Adelaide.
Yeah.
From Julie McKenzie. And you got something else out of that production, didn't you? In a more lasting term?
Yes, I got a husband.
Who we all know now, because we are all madly in love with him, as Carson in Downton Abbey, but
yes.
He was big...
Big Julie.
Big Julie.
He was the biggest, I was the smallest. It had to happen.
And then, obviously, there's been lots of other things, and I'm wanting to move through so that we can get people to ask questions. But let's continue. Let's talk about television.
Mm-hmm. Funnily enough, the first television I ever did, I think, was in 84, and it was directed... It was just at telly, I was at a little part, but it was directed by Gillian Lynn.
Oh, God, right.
Choreographer who choreographed Cats and all that. You know, so she directed the telly then. So that was my first telly. So television, I've done bits and bobs on the telly. Not too bothered about telly, particularly. I've done some good stuff. I've done some rubbish. That's a lot of my career. I feel very proud to have been part of The Singing Detective, for example, that was on in the 80s.
Yeah.
And Cranford.
You've done class, haven't you?
I've done a tiny bit of class. I've done a touch of class, to quote that film.
You made Cranford a bit of a family affair, I'm told.
Oh, yes. Our daughter did a couple of scenes in it, but I couldn't get the dog in it. So.
And your husband was in it as well.
And Jim.
And Jim was in it as well.
Yeah.
So Jim and Bessie were all in Cranford.
Yeah.
That's very good.
That was a nice... We didn't actually do a scene together, but it was very nice. Yeah.
And film?
Films, yes.
Peter Sprenz?
Yeah, that was nice.
Nice, your type of film?
That was good fun. And, you know, why it was nice was we filmed it up in Barnet and we rehearsed it for a week like you'd rehearse a play. We did a read-through and then we rehearsed it like you... And then we did a run-through like you do a play in chronological order all over the house that we filmed with the DOP, the director of photography, watching it all. And so it was like a play. And then we started filming it on the Monday. We filmed it in 4 weeks, and that was that. So it was that was a very nice job just up the road, thank you. Funnily enough, you know, the changing point for me was Vera Drake, mm-hmm. Mike Leigh's Vera Drake. But before that, you know, I'd turned up in films and bits in telly, but I sort of, again, you know, giving myself these reality checks... You know, I think the minute you start saying, oh, why aren't I, you know, Juliet Stevenson, why aren't I Julie Walters, or I'm so sorry that I'm not, to a lot of people, then you go, well, I'm not. So I'm doing these bits. And I remember thinking that very strongly. I did, there was a television series called Cambridge Spies, and I was asked to do two scenes in that as the Queen Mother. And I loved it. And it was just two scenes, and I thought, well, I've really loved doing that. And there's no point, so why aren't I playing the lead in something else? I really love that. And if that's what I do, if that's what people think about, I'd rather be doing that than at home moaning about not doing a bigger part. Mm-hmm. So I thought, fine, absolutely fine. And then Vera Drake happened, and that sort of, you know, changed a bit of the stuff publicly and put me further up at whatever bloody mm-hmm. list exists. But it also changed the way I worked, and to have that... hopefully halfway through my career, was like going and doing a sort of a university course on
that. How did that?
Well, just the way he works, I suppose, which is too long a thing to go into now.
Yeah.
But I think the main thing I got out of that, I'm always fairly serious and focused when I'm working anyway. But this really, really teaches you to keep your own counsel, which I think is very important. What does that mean? That means, particularly in theatre, you know, we're all rehearsing a play or whatever, and people go, it'd be really helpful for me if you just move it. Don't worry about that. Just do what you're doing. Just do what your character is doing, and hopefully the director, who has got this canvas, and you are, say, the colour blue, and it's his job to make that blue darker, lighter, or whatever. It's not your job to spill into the, you know, the yellow over there, or whatever. So that, it taught me that. I mean, I'll discuss things in rehearsal, obviously, but it really made me think about just do my job. And in a technical way on a film set, that's terribly useful because film sets are very noisy, unfocused places, it seems. Only because, I mean, we could all be doing a scene here. Props, you're all the props people, you're the camera people, you're the design people. There's lots of people doing their job, but it's my job to not be distracted by that. You know, it's not very helpful, actually, they're all making that noise. I'm trying to think. Well, fucking think on your own. That's your job. You know, no one else has to help you do that. You just get on with it. So that was, it was great, actually. I'm very grateful for that.
What's Oscar night like?
Not as nice as making the film. Much noisier.
No.
And mad. Of course, it was fabulous and all that. But I think I was the only person going to the Oscars with... I had a mate with me, Michael Simpkins, you might know him, who writes. And yeah. He's a mate anyway. And he said, oh, look, the Telegraph has said if I travel with you... I said, well, of course you must. And so we were in the... I was about to take the van going to the Oscars. I meant the limousine. in the van, anyway. And I said, look, we're all going to get starving. We'll be starving. So I said, look, we've got to have sandwiches in the car. Because otherwise, I said, because I'll get grumpy. If I'm hungry, I'll get grumpy. I don't want to be grumpy. So we were all there. And of course, we got there a lot quicker than I thought. So I'm trying to get things out of my teeth. Yes. It was hard work, is what it is,
because
you're on the whole time.
Yeah,
you really are. But the perks are being in the Four Seasons and going up in the lift with Morgan Freeman, and then going hello. those are the perks. Yeah, those are the perks. And yeah. And Leonardo and all this, you know, all that. Yeah. And your feet hurt, and it's... And I have to say, it was so far removed from the work that we'd done, so you could only think of it as a bit of, you know...
Yeah.
It is what it is. And I was very grateful that our film, and in that year, you also had Hotel Rwanda, and... Javier Bardem and I did a lot of the festivals. Penelope! Those films were up there in the Oscar, you know, those difficult, contentious sort of films were being noted. And so that was worthwhile. Yeah.
I'm asking a question now which is entirely selfish. And it's about... when I read Harry Potter... and the Order of the Phoenix, and I was reliving my childhood because of boarding school, which was an aspiration, obviously coming from Yorkshire, not a reality, and wizardry, which are fantastic. And I was reading Order of the Phoenix, and the films had started coming out at that point, and then this character came in, Dolores Umbridge, from the Ministry of... And one read it, and you just thought, how does anybody play this? And she's described. And then the film came. And I don't think you stole the picture. I think the expression is, I think they said it about Bette Davis, that you sort of committed grand larceny with it, really. Because it's such a fantastic performance. Where does it... Did you go to the book and then develop it, or did it come from...
Well, it's funny, because I hadn't got to that book, and a mate phoned up and said, oh, my God. I've just read this. You have to play that part. I said, oh, right. So I looked at it and it said, short, fat, ugly, toad-like. And that's a mate. I thought, oh, right. Anyway, so I read it. And, of course, actually, because she had bows in her hair and sort of stick out for us, and they didn't go for that. But I do remember going in to look at the designs, and people said, oh, you didn't say that. And I thought they were all wrong. And we had this wow, wonderful Jeannie, the French designer. She was so passionate. And anyway, so I went in and I said, and they were all there, the producers, the director. I said, I don't think this is right. And they all went. But then, you know, I only say that from a place of, because I said, I think she's got to be soft on the outside. And I said, I just imagine this sort of little glow of Angora. you know, that thing that Angora gives off. It's like another little layer of ooh, lovely. So that we could have that heart and soul of iced steel inside. And, you know, they bought it because I was doing it from a place of course, I wasn't saying I'm not wearing that, but actually we all discussed it. And, you know, she went and got all these cardigans knitted and things like that. But also David Yates, this was his first, who directed it, was his first Potter film. And he'd only ever done political dramas on the telly. And we talked an awful lot about Thatcher, ethnic cleansing, mm-hmm. and those sort of elements. And, you know, because I thought, oh, Harry Potter, just a bit of fun. And actually, it was a wonderful acting piece to do. And you know, I remember one scene, I mean, I was very disturbed, actually, for me, because, you know, I just do my job and go home. But actually, there was a scene where, you know, she makes him write, and it's, you know, the blood on colour. And that was really, afterwards, I thought, oh, that, you know, I went into a place, I thought, that's not very nice, the word, at all. So it was a really good acting experience, I have to say. It wasn't like, well, it's just a bit of Harry Potter. Yeah. It was very serious. Because, and also David, I remember David saying, look, there's no point in having all these effects if the middle, if the core of this, of my character, and the film, is not real and frightening. Yeah. So it was a wonderful job to do.
And that's why it worked so well.
I think so.
Because there is something that appeals to the child in you, or the child that they are quite. Mm.
And those people, I mean, let's face it, that we are all reading about, for goodness sake, in the papers now. I mean, that's not her deal, but the people that they are in positions of power, and they utterly and completely abuse it. You know, that's it's not a very nice person to be. But
do you dust your own Olivier's on the mantelpiece? Because there must be quite. There's quite a collection now, isn't there? I think, are you up to three?
Three.
The most recent for Mrs. Lovett.
Yeah.
And The Baker's Wife and Into the Woods. And then one for the National, which was a...
Oh, double one for...
Double one for Course of Disapproval and...
The Corn is Green.
The Corn is Green.
Mm. With Deborah Carr.
With Deborah Carr.
Yeah. I'm 72, you know. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, Baker's Wife, Sondheim, Mrs. Lovett, Sondheim. Mm. Are you a big fan? Is that the best music you can get?
I'm not a big fan of musicals, I have to say.
Okay, good.
Because I don't think many of them have good enough scripts. Yeah. You know, great music, and then just nya-nya in between. For my money, Guys and Dolls is...
Yeah.
The tops. I mean, obviously, I have a personal connection to that, but I just think it's a wonderful, wonderful script. Sondheim for me is challenging. That's what I want. That's what I like about it. I mean, both of those pieces, Woods and Sweeney, were really difficult, really, really difficult. And I love that. So that's what I just need to be challenged. I think we all want to be challenged, really. So I don't really want to do something that I think, oh, I can do that. That's easy. I don't want to do that.
That thing about stepping out and not knowing whether the pool's full and to dive.
Yeah.
What's coming up? There's a film coming out we were talking about.
A film called Pride.
Mm-hmm.
Which Matthew Warchus has directed.
Okay.
And it's about a true story of, not many people know about. During the miners' strike, there was a group called the Lesbians and Gays Support the Miners, who raised more money for this Welsh mining community than any other support group. And it went down a storm up Cannes. And it's opening in September, and it's a wonderful film. And Matthew, Stephen Beresford has written it, and it's really uplifting. It's hilarious, but it's really very moving.
So Pride,
yeah.
A bit of lesbian and gay backing, I suppose one of the hot tickets of the autumn is going to be you down in Chichester. Oh. Doing Gypsy.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Doing your Mama Rose.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Are you looking forward to it? No, is that a challenge?
No, not really. Of course, terrifying, so that's good. That's a good place to be. Yeah, frightened, yeah. Yeah. I never really wanted to, I'm not bothered about doing it. But anyway, I was very, Sondheim said, you have to play roles. Oh, right, OK. So I'm very lucky, and I've got Jonathan Kent, who directed Sweeney, directing it, the same MD, Nick Skilbeck. It's going to be a very big challenge. For me, I've seen everyone do it, and I saw Patty do it twice. She was just sublime. I don't need to do it now. You've done it. That's fine. But it's just another part. And what you mustn't get, I like to say this to myself, is don't get bogged down by people. Oh my God! Oh fantastic! Oh those great big songs. Shut up, that's so frightening to hear, because it's just another song. I think people think it's big songs only because bloody Ethel Merman, who was just, you switch her on and you switch her off, and that's sort of it. And marvellous she was too. And I think it carries that baggage of it being big, like that. So I have to come in under that and see where I find myself.
Okay. What's on the bucket list? Still to do.
I've never had a bucket list, because I do like new writing. I've just done a play called Good People,
which was just down the road.
And that was a wonderful piece of new writing, and I've always liked new writing. Maybe that's what, I haven't done all the Shakespeare's and all the Ibsen's and all that. I haven't, because I think there are a lot of actresses who want to play those parts, and I quite like to sort of put my stamp on something new, I suppose.
Okay, so lots of new stuff you want that you don't know about.
Yeah, maybe.
Okay, surprises.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, I'm going to hand over to everybody else now. Let them do the work. I'm sure there will not be an embarrassing pause when I go, who has a question for Imelda? So I'm looking for that first hand shooting up right now. And I've got it. It's a friendly face. Matthew.
Sweeney Todd, you've done, and it's come out as a film. Into the Woods, you've done, it's coming out as a film. Labels and all that kind of stuff that have been adapted from the musical for the cinema screen. What do you think about the adaptation from stage to screen, that transfer sort of thing?
Well, I think it's great, because more people will see it. When it works, it's fantastic. Mamma Mia worked brilliantly. You didn't think it would. You think, well, it's such a sort of, you just need the audience there, but it worked brilliantly. I wonder about, you sort of think, well, I wonder, now will they do more, live screenings of them, from the theatre.
Yeah.
They might start doing that more, I don't know. I mean, if it works, it's fine. I sort of thought, oh no, you need the audience, but I don't think you do really. I think if they film it properly, it really does work.
I think they need to learn the word interval. Because halfway through Les Miserables, when they got to the end of One Day More, and psychologically I was being told, I can now go to the loo, because this is what... And then it just carried on
for
another 90 minutes.
Yeah.
My bladder didn't like that at all.
It was very long, wasn't it? Yeah, it was too long.
It was a bit of an endurance test, Les Miserables. Another hand there, right at the back. Thank you very much.
Being an actress myself, I trained in musical theatre, and it's difficult to make transitions from one kind of performance to another. I've also done a bit of TV now as well, but to make that leap was huge. You don't seem to have had any problem going from musical theatre, TV, film. How do you explain that?
Well, what happened? when I finished that Guys and Dolls in 83, so we did from 82 to 83, I was then offered to take over in Blood Brothers. And I remember thinking then, if I do that, that's all I'm going to do. So I didn't. And I think probably because I'd done so much theatre in rep, maybe if I'd just done Guys and Dolls, I thought, oh yes, I'll go into Blood Brothers, because I knew that really what I loved best was just talking out loud. That's what I must do. I've got to make a sacrifice now. So that's what I did. And funnily enough, because Julie McKenzie, who I understudied because we worked together, you know, she found it hard. Because in the, well, for Julia, I mean, she did sitcoms, but it was quite hard for her to get into any serious drama because of all the musicals she did. She said that to me. You know, she said, "Oh, I found it so hard that no one will take me seriously because of musicals." And I think that is still true. I do think that's true. Mm-hmm. And I think you just have to make a decision, because you always go back to musicals, I think, a little bit. I mean, I did Sweeney, and this has happened now by sort of default. But before Sweeney, I don't know when I'd done one before that. So, you know, I hadn't done one for 10, 12 years. And so I just think you have to make a bit of a tough decision.
Did you know that musical side of you was in there? Because you did go to RADA, and it's to do the acting and the talking.
Mm.
Did it... Because I suppose then probably when people discovered that, when you did Guys and Dolls, and certainly when you took over from Adelaide, and you did have a reputation as an actress, and people were surprised, oh, you know, and she sings.
Well, people still say that. They do. People don't know I sing. Well, maybe they think I don't. But, but you know, so I'm not really known, I don't think, as a musical person. So, but I think if I'd stayed and gone into done takeovers and da-da, that I would have been.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it would have limited me, in a way. Because, I like to do, the variety. And again, I'm not saying I can do it all, but I like to give it a go. I love doing plays. I love doing plays. But I love the technical and the smallness of filming. Because it's like reducing, hopefully, what you're doing down to a really teeny tiny stock cube of concentration and focus. It's just so much smaller. And I think that's very good for us, to reduce things in order to sort of recharge, and then you take them out again. I think one feeds the other.
Yeah. Looking at that, right here at the front, right in my eye.
Where in your process do you start working on accents? I'm curious to know, for things like Good People, was that rehearsing in it from day one, or build into it,
or
is it difficult learning a new accent?
Yeah, Good People, I was playing a bar. Oh, fuck, I'm trying to do it. I'll be embarrassed now to try and do it. But anyway, a Southie Boston, so it's Paddy and Carpack and all that. I didn't have as much prep time as I really wanted on that, but Penny Dyer, who was our voice dialect coach, who I'd worked with all last year and I'm working with her again this year, I got her to just lay down some stuff for me that I could just be listening to in the months leading up to rehearsals. But actually, it didn't really start until we were properly rehearsing. So that was 4 weeks, and she came in. But also we had the writer, David Lindsay Abair, came for our second week of rehearsal, and that was really helpful, actually, to have him there, and he would correct us on a few things, which was great. And I think the accent, of course, goes hand in hand with the character, because you can't be the character unless you've got her voice. And
it was amazing. Forgot it was you at
times. All right, good, good.
You sound like you were born there.
Uh-huh.
So that's why I was curious.
Oh, hurrah.
Yeah.
Oh, hurrah.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
To take that accent and perfect it is...
Yeah.
Enough.
Well, I think it would have been... I don't think my accent would have been good if I was doing The Importance of Being Earnest in a South Boston accent. I think the writing really helps you to live in it. Totally written in it, yeah. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Thank you. Over here, and then I'll come up there.
Hi. I love what you say about constantly reassessing your work. I think that's really terrific and important. I was watching a film with Meryl Streep, one of her very early films, and it's still Meryl Streep, and she was good, but she hadn't reached that greatness that we kind of all aspire to. And I just wondered, on your journey to wonderfully great acting, I just wondered if you can give us any tips about your realisations about... from when you went to being a good actor, from when you arrived at being a great actress.
Well, I don't think I am a great actress. It's very nice to say that. I do think Vera Drake changed things for me from an acting point of view, about reducing and only thinking your character's thoughts. And that's on stage as well. You know, if you're thinking about other things. I mean, we all think about other things on stage, of course, because it's much more sort of tangible and it's live and things are moving, something could go wrong. In a film, you've got those 15, 20 seconds of pure focus and concentration, much easier to stay in the character. But you have to retain that when you're on stage. And I have since then. So Vera, that was 2003. So since then, it's been much easier for me on stage to only think about what my character is feeling and saying. And particularly in Good People, I wasn't... I mean, of course, you go, you know, I wish they'd stop coughing! You do that, of course. But that takes up that much. Rather, you know, it would have taken up a lot more space, but actually I fill my head with the character. And I think, talking about, you know, what helps you do that, and I think filming in Mike Lee's way really helps you do that. And I think you can see from all the actors that he works with, Leslie Manville and Tim Swall, Jim Broadbent, you know, those actors who've got this sort of stillness and ability to just only do what they are doing. And also, you know, let's face it, God knows, I spent a lot of my career being, you know, mediocre in very bad work, but you learn from that too. But there's no doubt, so doing something like Good People, which I think was great writing, it makes you a better actor. And, you know, good writing on television, on film, or in theatre makes you better. And of course, having a director who can, even with David Yates on Harry Potter, can really feed you and point you in the right direction. And of course, that right direction is in.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that. And I remember, and I sort of tested it out actually on a technical level with Good mm-hmm. People. I remember, you know, actors sort of say, you know, so you're the audience there, and you say, well, I've got a funny line, so I better do it out there. And I remember I had a funny line. I thought, you know what, I'm going to do it right up there. Still, just got the same laugh. I thought, well, there you go. Don't give me any of that bollocks about, you know, oh, darling, I think you'll find I need to look out here in order to get that laugh. No, you don't, because if it's real, you'll get it wherever it is. So that was good. That was a good lesson, to learn. But you've got to get good writing for that, then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Okay, there was a hand there. Yeah.
As you spoke about how acting is a craft that you have to be continually working on. Has there ever been a stage in your career where there's been a lull in the work? And if so, like, how did you continually work on the craft through that?
Well, I mean, I have to say, touch wood, I haven't had many lulls, but, and probably because I would just take the next job. Oh, it's not a very big part. Well, it's work, and I will take it. And I have to say, I didn't go to classes or anything. So, well, there weren't that many around. And I also sort of, and I sort of thought, well, I don't know why I never did, but I would. Yeah, you see, I'm not very good. I just go into neutral. Really, really boring, because I just sort of shut down, which is not good. Because I sort of say, talk to students, say, look, go out and be a waitress, or do something just to get yourself out every day. Now I can say that from my position now, but there was a time just before I did Guys and Dolls. Actually, I got a job in a Greek restaurant in the kitchen, and they said I worked like a Trojan. I'm a bloody grafter, I'll tell you that.
Hang on, in a Greek restaurant, they said you worked like
a
Trojan.
Yes, I know that. I know, but they did say. That's what they said to me. Yeah. So the lulls are always going to be difficult, actually. You know, probably whether you're doing something else or not. Because, you know, when I'm working, I am in my element.
Mm.
And when you are out of your element, it's very uncomfortable. You know.
But I think one of the things that we're concentrating on here at the moment is that actually as an actor, you are working all the time and you need to be working all the time. And you might have to do other things to survive.
Mm.
But that classes and things need to be linked to work.
Mm.
and the end result, because when you're flourishing and when you're in that element is when you have that work.
And also, what places like this allow you to be around like-minded people, and that's rather nice feeling, to be with your tribe, because it is a sort of tribe.
Yeah.
No matter where you are on the ladder, you're on the ladder, and it doesn't matter, because you can be up in that rung, and then you can go down the bottom. No matter where you are, it's always shifting. Probably not for Merrill. I had lunch with her at a mate's house. I was going round to my mate. She said, look, Meryl Streep's coming over. And my reaction was, I was doing the play and I was knackered. And she said, I've just come over for lunch. I thought, oh, great, lunch, Sunday lunch, great. I don't have to cook. She said, look, Meryl Streep's coming. And I went, oh, for God's sake! I think, oh, I've got to be bloody... I've got to be on now, because she's come up. And, of course, nothing further from the truth. She was so... And I was sitting, I was going, sitting next to Meryl Streep. She was just... Just lovely. So that was very exciting. So that shot me up. Yeah. Okay.
Very good. I'm going to go right to the back, and then I'm going to come down here. So right at the back, yeah.
Hi, just wondered, having worked for as long as you have, do you think the processes have changed in creative work? And have you had to develop your skills in terms of, I guess, like the changing philosophies of how to create good work?
Well, I think always good work should always be truthful, no matter which way you slice it. So that will never change. I am hearing from my daughter what they're learning now at drama school is sort of different. But bottom line, it's got to be truthful. And that's in a 3,000-seater or making a one-camera piece of film. I don't know what's going to happen with... Well, actually, I just saw King Lear, which was fantastic. Purely on a vocal note, the upward inflection... all the time. I don't know what that's going to do. But you're just going to sound so stupid, because you don't sound like you're confident at all in what you're saying. Everything's just about that long. What's that about? So, on a technical note, because I think, well, if you're doing a modern play, playing a character like that, fine. But you're doing Shakespeare. I don't know how you're going to do that. But but actually, having said that, I did see King Lear, and it was fine actually. But in that respect, I think people have got to sort of keep an eye on that, on the voice that just doesn't have any integrity. It just does this, because that's what everyone does. I know that sounds a bit mean, isn't it? I don't care! I don't care. Okay, now...
Brilliant.
Do you have... Like, when you're auditioning, it's kind of such a weird, specific thing that kind of... It's kind of terrifying, and you don't kind of do the same kind of work that then you get to do when you're actually been given the part, because you're sort of still like having that, oh, please pick me.
Yeah, yeah.
And what do you have any advice that you found really helpful for yourself?
Well, you really have to... that's so hard to say, isn't it? To be yourself, because of course we all go in there terrified, and that's quite hard, isn't it? To then go, and I'm completely calm. but remember, on the other side of the table is just as difficult. Mm. I've been the other side of the table, and as an actor, I think, well, look, you can't tell from 2 minutes, surely. You can. So don't think you needed to see me longer to get the real me. No, I didn't actually. And that did surprise me. If I'm on this side of the table, auditioning someone, it is my job to make them comfortable. It's also our job on the other side of the table to make them comfortable too.
Absolutely.
So you don't go in there with a, I think you should, I think you need to employ me. That's not going to happen. Or, oh, could you? No, that's not going to happen. And look, you know, what my body did then, I think you should have... Good. Right, you need to be right where you are, above your soul, sitting in your skin. And that's difficult, I know, but that's something that I think really helps.
Is that sort of part of a life process? Because I always term it that... I know as a young actor, I used to go into auditions and go, I'm an actor, I can be... What would you like me to be? I can be anything, because I'm an actor. And actually, I got to a certain point in my life, which was to do with where I was personally as well, going, well, this is what I am. Would you like it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You are the best you there is.
Mm.
And I take that in. And it's not because I'm bad or good if I don't get it. It's because I am not right for what they're looking for. And like you, I've sat on both sides of the table and you see that. And sometimes it's nothing to do with anything you can control. I once did 45 minutes auditioning for a takeover of Hamlet. And the director said, fantastic, fantastic, fantastic. And at the end of it, he went, it's not going to work because you are too tall. And it was a takeover, so it had to be somebody of 5'8 to fit the costumes. I was 6'2" when I walked in the room, and remained it throughout the whole of the scenario. I probably shrank an inch when he told me I was too tall. But I think it's part of a self-knowledge, isn't it? That that actually I can focus this in different ways, but this is what I am.
Mm. Yeah, because there is that percentage of... No matter what you walk in as, you might not be right because it's just, oh, no, it should be tall or small or whatever. There's all that element is in the mix as well. So it's not all... Because we always say, it's me and I'm, you know, constant rejection and failure and, of course, what that does to our self-confidence and blah, blah. But, you know, when you're not alone. We've all been through it and we will all keep going through it in different ways. But I think the idea of, you know, not being too like that, or, you know, you either want me or you don't want me, that, what's that to do with? I mean, I used to just, I would just go, no, what have you been doing? Oh, nothing, I just, I was at the National Theatre, and, I was at the National Theatre doing, you know, and I'd undersell, and that's sort of a weird one as well, because you think, what's that? Is that like a false modesty thing? Do you know, I'm nothing really. Meaning, what does that mean? Does that mean you're so great you can't even bloody talk about it? So I had to give myself, again, you know, what are you doing? So to be able to be comfortable, and I know that's hard, but that's what you sort of have to learn how to be, because it's also like a part. You know, you go into that room and it's the part of someone trying to audition. You know, so you might not have to be... Now I can walk in and I am very comfortable because, that's fine. But to go in and go, right, I'm going to be as positive as I can be without being pushy or whatever, and or not be that you're so... sort of nervous that you're aggressive, I'd get that.
Yeah, it's fine.
Oh,
it?
terrible. So it's I think it's a constant battle. And one that you sort of, it changes. I think the older you get, it changes. I mean, sometimes, you know, people get less confident as they get older, not necessarily more confident. And that's something you should look out for and take care of yourselves. And do not give yourselves a bad time when you don't get it. I mean, as I said, no matter where you are on the ladder, it's going to happen. It's not just people who, I didn't get another job. We all didn't get the other job, or the next job, or the next job. It's happened to us. That's what the life is. If you can handle that, you can handle doing this job. We're all fine when we're working, as we're, you know, saying, it's the in-between bits. But then if you don't get the job, and go home and get depressed and eat the whole packet of chocolate digestives. Oh, yeah. And then, you know, then tomorrow's another day. And that's what, and that's the thing, if you can get up again, whenever it's, if it's a day later, an hour later, 3 weeks later, you get up again and off you go again. And that's what makes you stronger, is how you recover.
I'm going to put in your minds, I'm looking for a quirky question now that we might use to come to a close. There was a hand up there. I'm going to go with you and hope you're quirky.
I'm going to reframe my question. Is there a really bad review that you've ever read of yourself that really sticks in the way? Or a really positive one?
Look at me, touching wood. No. And I say that, and I think because I'm sort of pretty... I'm always sort of reliable. You know what I mean? I don't think I'm extraordinary enough. I'm not being that. I don't think I'm... you know, there's your acting, and I'm sort of in there. And then you have people up in that place, and people somewhere. And I just think I'm always fairly reliable. That's why. So, and I think... You know, that first thing when he said I was so boring, that got me. And that got me thinking, you know, and that got me thinking. And, I don't think I take huge risks, probably the material that I take or the choices I make. But that's just what I am and what I do. And also now, oh, yeah, that's a good point. Also now, well, the last sort of 5 years... I thought, God, wouldn't it be liberating not to ever read a review? And that didn't come from anything that had happened. But, it, you know, if people say, oh, you're she's marvellous, marvellous, marvellous. Well, I find that really hard, A, to accept, but also to then go and act upon. And I think if they say, oh, that line where she says, don't quote me a line, because then it's in my head the way I can't think about it in any other way, but I can only think about that line. So I don't want to hear about a line that's marvellous or a line that's terrible. Or, oh, that scene, you say, this just doesn't work because of this, that and the other. There's no use to me. If it was useful, I would read them. But I think some reviews are... I mean, I read other reviews, and some of them are useful. But I think when you're in it... Unless it's your director or fellow actors who I love, when I was doing Good People, we'd say, was that a bit rubbish, wasn't it tonight? Let's try that little bit, do that, you know, talk about it. That's fine. But having an expert tell me how to do something, I wish they'd been in the rehearsal room, because I can't take it on. It's not useful. It's useful for other people, but not for the people who are in it, I think.
Well,
anything else quickly? Anyone else quickly? No. Oh,
there's one there. Come on.
This is my question. This is I can remember.
Well, you're giving me a shopping list. What are you going to do?
I can remember you as Lizzie, and with Johnny McTeer, and I can't remember the name.
Masculine Ending was one. It was called A Masculine Ending. Was one of them. We did two things. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, thank you. Jolly good. Okay. It was nearly a shopping list of stuff I'd done, but no.
Well. Yeah. I've got a few housekeeping announcements to do, but I can say, and I'm sure everybody will join with me, it's been marvellous to chat to you for an hour. It's given me a whole new memory of you, other than you getting off the stage at Nottingham Playhouse on that night. And, ladies and gentlemen, the delightful Imelda Staunton.
There it is. Wow. Wasn't that just inspiring? I found it so fascinating, so interesting. These off-the-record talks are brilliant. So what do you think? Let us know. Go onto our website, don'tbesodramatic.com, and comment on the show, or leave us a positive review on iTunes. Also, tweet us. Let us know what you thought on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @DBSDpodcast, or you can tweet @TheActorsCentre and let us know what you thought. The next off-the-record talk coming up is with myself and Paul Clayton. Paul Clayton is going to be sitting in the other chair and I get to ask the questions. So don't forget to reserve your tickets, book your place on the next off-the-record talk. It's free for Actors Centre's members. Go to theactorscentre.co.uk and email reserve your place. Come along, 24th of July, 12:30, me and Paul Clayton. Okay, so that's it for this week. Hope you've enjoyed the show. I'm Steve Bradley. Don't be so dramatic.